Hello everyone and welcome back to the Crim Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Espresso Warriors Katara. Just remember you guys to eat, drink and be social at Espresso Warriors. I would like to begin this episode by paying our respects to and acknowledge the Awabakal people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we live. We would like to acknowledge and extend these respects to all elders, past, present, and emerging. A quick disclaimer to warn that today, like a normal day in criminology, we discuss interesting but sensitive topics that some of you may find to be disturbing or distressing. This week's episode contains discussions on police excessive force, the Jamie Jackson Reid viral video, and the viral video of George Floyd. Listener discretion is advised. However, if you find that you are impacted by anything we discuss today, we encourage you to employ the free counselling services provided by the New University or Headspace in Newcastle City. For crisis support, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or reach out to us and we'll be happy to help. Today, we are incredibly lucky to be joined by Dr. Justin Ellis. Justin has an interdisciplinary background with an undergraduate degree in history, and a master's and PhD in criminology. He has a background in communications and media and is a proud lecturer at the University of Newcastle. So let's jump right in. So in your research, you examined the impact of digital media technologies on police-civilian relations with a focus on lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and the queer community, so LGBTQ community. Your upcoming book draws on a range of case studies, the main one being the police excessive force against Jamie Jackson Reid at the 2013 Sydney Mardi Gras parade. Why was this video so important, Justin?
Oh, thanks, Tamika. This video, even though it was shot in 2013, was important for a range of reasons. One was that at that time, many people didn't know that it was lawful, generally lawful, to film police operations in public. In conjunction with people not being aware of that capacity, we also had the capacity to share through social media networks reaching a critical mass. So overnight, this video went viral. And I think after 2 weeks, it had about 2 million views. Now, by 2020 standards, that might sound like not very much. By 2013 standards, that was a hell of a lot of traffic very quickly. The other aspect of this video was that it clearly marked a line in the sand between the rising power of bystander social media video and the mainstream media really watching from the sidelines and picking up the story and then incorporating it into its mainstream news media feeds. So there are a couple of the dimensions that were really important about this video at that time.
So in that viral video, the police repeatedly ask the person recording to stop filming them. Is it lawful for people to film police officers in public?
Yes, and that's probably the main point of this discussion today for your listeners, is that generally filming police operations in public is lawful as long as you're not obstructing police in what they're doing. So it's also very important to bear in mind that recording police operations can be quite stressful, because they often involve situations that might include excessive force. They may be at a large event with lots of noise and bystanders and drunk people and intoxicated people. And we saw this with the George Floyd case in Minneapolis earlier this year, where Daniela Fraser, the 17-year-old who filmed that video, which is over 8 minutes, held the camera very still. It was very clear what was going on. That can be used in court to resolve matters more quickly. It identifies civilian and police behaviours very quickly. And if the video is clear and there's good resolution, it can expedite some of those processes. But the short answer is yes, it's generally lawful to film police operations in public as long as you're not obstructing the police in their operations.
How does exposure of police excessive force through bystander social media video impact police accountability and transparency?
This is a great question, Tamika, because whenever there's a new technological development, social media being one of the most recent in our lifetimes, there's this debate that comes forward that suggests that it might be a panacea, and then the counter argument is that it's going to compromise privacy and so on. So in terms of the exposure of police excessive force through bystander social media video, I guess from my research, I would make the distinction between social media and bystander video pressuring the police to account in shorter time frames compared to what they were used to. So the police have to justify their actions more quickly to a broader audience, but in the longer term, it doesn't necessarily generate or translate into police institutional accountability in the sense that the processes that the police are engaged in haven't changed that much in terms of perhaps not commensurately to what digital audiences might expect because of the speed that that digital technologies allow us to, send information, expect responses and so on. So there's still a reasonable amount of work to be done on police accountability, particularly to civilians who might have been involved in a case of police excessive force. If the police invoke their right to conduct an internal investigation, that means that the civilian won't have access to the outcome. So there's a problem there with resolution for victims.
The video footage and media coverage from the Jamie Jackson Reid incident mobilised the Sydney LGBTQ community to protest, which was organised through social media networks. What was the objective of these protests, Justin?
So that process, taking us again back to 2013, the community action against homophobia were largely at that time organising marriage equality protests. Yeah. And that reminds us that it wasn't until 2017 that same-sex marriage became lawful in this country and the many years it took to bring that about. The objective of the protest was, partially to raise awareness of police brutality, and the video obviously provided evidence that police brutality was occurring. And it also, having done some interviews with people connected to the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras and a whole range of other community NGOs, many of those people had spoken to the police as early as 2010 about some of the policing tactics at Mardi Gras and the Mardi Gras Festival. So it was also a way for people that had been working with the police, and this is what I call, as an aspect of my research, conflicted intimacy. You've got police and communities, LGBT communities, working very closely together on a whole range of levels, particularly the policy level. There's a lot of exchange of information and sharing, and the New South Wales Police Force set up the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officer Program in the 1980s and its forebears as a response to the police brutality at the 1978 inaugural Mardi Gras parade. So there's a long history over many decades of the New South Wales Police Force positively responding to community concerns. But 2010 to say 2013, there was a period there where perhaps the police could have listened more pointedly to what the community were asking for in terms of engagement. So the objective of the protest, a couple of points just to recap, to raise awareness of the ways in which police use tactics at major events and how they may not be commensurate with community values. And also to the broader policy push was to have more civilian oversight of police accountability mechanisms. So police complaints handling, for example, and police internal investigations, but that hasn't been effected.
Okay. So what were the outcome of these protests?
There were many positive outcomes from the protest. And this is an important point to make. As much as we're digital citizens now, and we may be, I use the term slacktivism advisedly, but we may be signing online petitions, we may be getting involved in advocacy online, but there's still merit in gathering publicly, and the Black Lives Matter movement in response to the death of George Floyd resonated globally. There's still a need for people to gather to show their withdrawal of consent or the dissatisfaction in public. And the outcome was that it did raise awareness about perhaps a deterioration of police LGBT community relations over many years. It provided an opportunity, or it provided a scandal because of the publicisation of that transgression. It provided an opportunity for change. The LGBTQ community developed a policy document and presented that to the New South Wales Police. The New South Wales Police Force have implemented most of those recommendations. So on the policy level, it was very, very useful. particularly with the police that I interviewed and super, from superintendent level, it provided them with a very frank assessment of public sentiment. And one of the problems with, I think the further you get involved in hierarchies is that the hierarchy might not be fully aware of the sentiment at the street level. And it provided a very quick and frank assessment to the police of public sentiment. And I think that was over the longer term, that was incredibly useful.
In your study, you mentioned that there is a benefit from heightened scrutiny of police excessive force through digital surveillance. Would you mind telling us what that is?
We usually think of surveillance being top-down scrutiny of subordinates by authorities. So surveillance is the inverse of that, where you've got scrutiny of authority from below, and bystander social media video is a very potent example of the scrutiny of authority from below. And in cases of police excessive force, what this allows civilians to do is, and because we can rewatch video, is it allows civilians to go back and isolate the elements of police conduct within an incident of police excessive force that they believe is or concedes proportionate as far as they're concerned, and elements that aren't. So this helps us reevaluate policy and delineate between what the public might consider proportionate versus the, what they can see in the video and what the police are actually doing. So Bentham said, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, and bystander social media video provides that disinfectant in terms of clarifying processes and procedures to civilians, but it also helps clarify them to police. There's research that's been done, particularly on YouTube videos of police excessive force, that show that police modify their behavior when they know they're being filmed. And this is where body-worn cameras come into play. That's probably the most recent incarnation of, that's not surveillance, so that's still surveillance because police wear those cameras on their person. This is all obviously in a continuum of surveillance, but with social media, we've got more capacity to surveil or watch authority from below.
So we'll move on to the question about negative perceptions of procedural justice. So within the LGBTQ communities, there can be lower levels of trust in the police and just general negative perceptions of procedural justice. Could you tell us why?
Yes. Partially, and this depends on demographic age group, we saw the results from the same-sex marriage survey in Australia in 2017, massive shift there and an acknowledgement across all jurisdictions in Australia that 60% of Australians agree that same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. However, if you were growing up gay in the late 1970s, for example, even through to 2000 in New South Wales, you weren't necessarily afforded that kind of treatment. Homosexuality wasn't decriminalised in New South Wales until 1984. It wasn't decriminalised in Tasmania until 1997, and that was after protracted legal negotiations to get Tasmania to effect that law reform. But between, say, the 70s and up to 2000, the criminal justice system had at its disposal levers through which to bring about accountability to perpetrators of assault and violent crimes against or prejudice motivated crimes against sexual minorities, but criminal justice institutions didn't always use those levers. So that meant that sexual and gender minorities invoked the capacity of the identity politics movement and the hate crime movement and tried to affect change in that way. That's been successful in some ways, but I think equality is probably a better way to go about it and achieve those reforms.
Well, in the case of Jamie Jackson Reid, in the video, an eyewitness says that all of the officers attending the arrest of Jamie Jackson Reid were responsible. How do police and public understandings of force differ?
This is a crucial element of trying to, educate the public about the necessity of police use of force in some contexts, but also the necessity of police to understand that civilians, well, they know this, that civilians are not necessarily going to understand. The police also don't want to disclose the tactics that they use so that they can then be used against the police. So this also came up in the arrest of George Floyd and the charging of the arresting officer there, but also the charging of the, I think, three other officers that were at that scene with aiding and abetting. This is contentious because typically the original jurisdiction of the constable, the police officer, means that they have that right or the authority as an individual, and extrapolating their responsibility out to others is not something that we see. I think the point here is that the public, clearly with the George Floyd case, and we saw it with the Jamie Jackson case, not only with one of the eyewitnesses in the video, but some of the people I interviewed, the public don't understand, if it looks like excessive force, why other officers aren't intervening to prevent further excessive or continued excessive force against a civilian. So clearly there's at minimum, there needs to be some form of education about why other police officers aren't stepping in to stop the excessive force. That's an area that is up for debate, particularly in the United States. But it's also, I wouldn't say it's a hot topic here, but clearly the public expect there to be greater accountability of all of the police in attendance when there is a case of excessive force.
What are the broader impacts of bystander social media video on police performance?
I've touched on a couple of those. One is that if police know that they're being filmed, they will modify their behaviour, and that can translate into reduced incidences of excessive force and also reduced use of force. So there's definitely positive impacts. There's also evidentiary impacts in the sense that it can be used, as I said, to expedite cases at court. If it's very clear on the video what has happened, then that can expedite cases. But the general point is that these cases need to be taken on a case-by-case basis. It's not that easy to generalise and say bystander social media video has managed to affect expedition of X number of cases and so on. Maybe that's an area for future research.
Alrighty. So are police internal investigations accessible to the public, Justin?
No, they're not. And as I mentioned earlier, this is an issue for victims who might get caught up in a case of police excessive force, or even if it's not deemed as excessive force, they won't be privy to the outcomes of those internal investigations. And the point where police excessive force has been used, and it's been ruled by a magistrate that it has been police excessive force, and this is another impact of bystander video, where in the Mardi Gras video, the Jamie Jackson Reid video in 2013, you can hear the gasps of the eyewitnesses. People are visibly and audibly distressed. When people were watching it online, they were also distressed. So the problem here is that police excessive force can generate fear. And if we don't have a resolution, or if we don't have disclosure of the outcomes of police internal investigations in those high profile media cases of police excessive force, we don't have closure. There's a sense of uncertainty and a safety issue if we don't know the outcomes of those particular cases. And perhaps more disclosure in certain cases might resolve.
I think it would do wonders for community trust in the police force. I know personally, if something terrible were to happen to me or to a family member or a friend or just a community member, anyone in general, I know I would love to be able to know what was going on with that, because I feel like when it's under the books and under the rug and no one really knows what's going on, I feel like they're not getting what they deserve if they've done something wrong.
Well, yes. But the other point to bear in mind is that there are procedural requirements that need to be gone through. I guess my point is that perhaps those procedures in some way, if they could be, while maintaining procedural justice, if they could be expedited in some way, that might alleviate public concerns once those processes have been completed. Obviously, once a case is in train, it's important to make sure that procedural integrity is maintained. But do we have the balance right? They're the questions we're always asking within criminology and criminal law, the balance between police obligations and civilian rights. And social media video definitely provides us with an opportunity to correct those imbalances more regularly, click by click, view by view, because we've got access to all this what we call digital abundance.
We'll move on to the ways that the police have attempted to restore police legitimacy. And that was through a memorandum of understanding, which was signed between the Mardi Gras and the New South Wales Police Force about policing the Mardi Gras parade. Could you tell us a little bit more about this unprecedented memorandum?
Yes, and so it was a memorandum of understanding signed between the New South Wales Police Force and the Mardi Gras about how the Mardi Gras festival is policed. We think of the Mardi Gras as the parade and the party on the last Saturday night of the festival, but it's typically a month long series of events that involve a whole range of different policing operations and so on. So the principle, the overarching principle, is to police the Mardi Gras festival as a celebration and not as a protest that had its origins in protests in 1978. So it's also, the principle is also to maximise engagement. And the point about maximising it, as in policing the community in the way that the community might expect, while obviously upholding the principles of criminal law. The point about engagement is that it underscores trust and confidence in not only in the police, but in any hierarchical relationship. So engagement is really important. But as I've said, the New South Wales Police Force through the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officer Program have done that incredibly well and continue to do so. But what we see with major events, the political economy of policing comes into play here. We saw with 2013, and this happens at other major policing events as well, we had a bit of a cult. Well, this is also a limitation of the way that the police responded. We had a bit of a cultural clash between different police forces and the different standards that they're used to affecting when they're policing public order events. So that also tapped into perceptions of homophobia in the 2017 same-sex marriage survey, because several of the police who were, well, definitely one police officer that did use police excessive force, and I think one other, were from jurisdictions in Western Sydney who had the lowest yes vote in the same-sex marriage survey. So the whole argument that police are homophobic is one that's, it's almost a moot point. It's almost unprovable. But we did see that if police in those communities were policing in a certain way in response to their communities and the engagement and trust that they had there, it did not translate very well into the culture of inner city Sydney and the police public relations there. So, and that had a direct impact on police that were working within those inner city communities, a very detrimental impact in terms of their relations with the community and how they were perceived.
Actually, I found that really interesting as I was reading your research to see that there was, because obviously different police groups and different forces from different areas will have different approaches to different events. So it was really enlightening to see that in some cases, we do have police that are executing the law and balancing our rights incredibly well, and they do an incredible job. But then there are, in other instances, perhaps people that don't operate the same way. And this is how we sort of come up with incidences like the Jamie Jackson Reid one. So it's like, it's interesting to see that they were then impacted despite having a good community relation within the city.
Yes. Yes. And this, the point being that to affect engagement as a police institution, you need to be consistent across all the media touch points and in person. That's a hard task, don't get me wrong, but the police know this because they're incredibly competent media users and are generating significant public discourse through their media units and what have you. But if all of those messages aren't aligned between community diversity initiatives like the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officer Program, police prosecutorial approaches, and police institutional responses to police transgression, then that is definitely going to impact trust and confidence at the community level. And that's where, at the community level, at the coalface, those officers are the people in the front line who are going to have to deal with that negative backlash.
I don't think as a community it is necessarily a bad thing for us to expect, I guess, consistency amongst the force because of the power and the discretion that they have. And I think we're still trying to figure it out and we're still debating about it.
The digital discourse now is part of a continuing conversation between police obligations and their balance with civilian rights. We see across most contexts that the police do get the balance right, but we know that there's always room for improvement. And this is where the constant dialogue facilitated through social media allows us to do this in much shorter timeframes and with a much broader variety of audiences. If we think back to mass communication and what we call unidirectional communication of, say, television, radio, and print, it broadcasts to, you know, broadcast. It's in the word broad. It went to a very broad audience and provided very narrow perspectives. We've got through digital diffusion and abundance, we've got a broad spectrum of experiences and understandings, and the dialogue now is as broad as platforms will allow for. So it, hopefully we can have a much richer debate about effective policing and the balance, the proportionality, which and getting the balance right between police obligations and civilian rights.
Is the police and LGBTQ relationship still a sensitive one, Justin?
Yes, I think it's a sensitive one because of its historical origins, but also because the LGBT community in Sydney is, in New South Wales at least, is, and many similar communities across the world, is very politically engaged, is very socially aware, and is potentially more aware of its rights than other communities. And that's also a consequence of being stigmatized, the criminalization of same-sex relations for centuries in many jurisdictions. So I don't necessarily see this as a bad thing, and what I call conflicted intimacy, given also some of the inner city areas where a lot of LGBT people live, that they're highly policed, they're highly surveilled. So I see it as a going back to checks and balances. It's almost like there's a, you know, a passive surveillance of policing in those areas. And I don't see that as a negative. And as we've seen with the benefits of bystander social media video, it helps police, it helps prosecutors, it helps defence lawyers, it helps magistrates make decisions about getting the balance right between police obligations and civilian rights. So as much as it's a sensitive one, we often think of these days of sensitivity as being a value that we prioritise in understanding people and prioritising engagement. So I see sensitive there as a, perhaps it also equates to receptivity, being receptive to listening to community needs and expectations and responding in a way that would benefit everyone.
So like I mentioned before, you do discuss this quite often in class, and it is very much integrated into our criminology syllabus, which I think is excellent. But how can we as students get involved with furthering LGBT plus rights within the criminal justice system? How can we become involved as activists?
There are a range of ways one can get involved. And locally, I would direct people to the University Ally Network, so ALLY Network page. And there are a range of resources there, including information about the UON Queer Collective and the Hunter Gender Alliance. We've also got on there the contact details of New South Wales Police Force gay and lesbian liaison officers. If you are in a situation where you might want to seek, not advice, but get in touch with them about any matters you might have experienced with New South Wales Police. So that's the first port of call. Obviously, we've discussed in this podcast, it's all about digital discourse and the breadth and depth of the possibilities of engaging online. So there are also other opportunities online to do that. What I would also urge you to do, though, if you're interested in how to safely film police operations in public, and I emphasise the word safe, because the first priority is to make sure that you are safe, is that the Inner City Legal Centre, which is based in King's Cross in Sydney, they had an initiative that was born out of, or they redeveloped one of their existing campaigns prior to the policing of the 2013 Mardi Gras, and they developed a program called Fair Play, and it outlines your rights and also details how to safely film police operations in public. So I think that's probably the key takeaway from this podcast, is that it is generally lawful to film police operations in public as long as you're not obstructing the police, but you need to know how to do that safely, and you need to know that this is where Daniela Fraser, for example, the 17-year-old that filmed the George Floyd arrest, she received negative commentary online because people argued that she didn't do enough to step in to help George Floyd. And as she said, she was afraid for her own safety, and she's 17, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're things that people need to bear in mind even though we know that generally lawful filming of police operations in public is lawful.
Well, thank you so much for those recommendations, Justin. I think it's really important, especially as young students, and we have our own queer community here in Newcastle as well. It's important for you guys to know your rights and what you're entitled to and how to go about these things safely. So listen back and look at some of the information that Justin has out there. If you have any concerns whatsoever, feel free to reach out to myself and we can connect you up with Justin if you have any concerns. But there is always the Legal Centre in Newspace as well that would be happy to help with anything like that.
Yeah, thanks, Tamika. And also, as much as we've concentrated on the LGBT community, LGBTQ community here, these messages resonate with everyone. So I think there's a broader message there as well.
And I think we can so very easily be overwhelmed by police officers in general. They can be very scary, especially with the discourse recently surrounding the Black Lives Matter movements. There's not a lot of public trust at the moment. And I think if a police officer were to turn around and tell me, put that away, you're not allowed to do that, I would follow orders. So it's good to know where we stand as a community and what we are entitled to. Anyway, guys, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us on the CRIM podcast and your consistent support throughout the semester as well, Justin.
You're welcome, Tamika. And I would like to thank you all for doing such a great job and raising the profile of criminology at the university.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to the CRIM podcast. On this week's episode, you are joined by your host, Tamika Hillebrand, and Dr. Justin Ellis. This week's episode was sponsored by Espresso Warriors at Katara. Credit goes to Corey DiPasquale, who is the editor, producer, and music composer of this episode. Thanks to Joseph DiPasquale for providing the podcasting equipment, and big shout out to Isabella Krebert for her administrative support and assistance. We'll see you next time.